Alfie Cohn is a parent. He's also a former teacher. He is now an author and lecturer. He's an outspoken critic of traditional classrooms and the back-to-basics approach to schooling. His latest book is The Schools Our Children Deserve, Moving Beyond Traditional Classrooms and Tougher Standards. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Alfie Cohn, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what's wrong with schools the way we remember them?
To begin with, the fact that understanding of the ideas we were taught is minimal. In most cases, even among those people who were successful in conventional terms. The traditional approach to education sees kids as being like passive receptacles into which facts or skills are poured, and this is not consistent with the best theory and research and practice about how people actually learn. So even apart from kids who dropped out or tuned out and came to think of themselves as stupid because they couldn't make it in a traditional kind of classroom, even the success stories, the kids who got great grades and went on to expensive colleges, often didn't really care much about what it is they were learning and didn't really understand the significance of what they're learning. And to the extent there's a problem with our schools these days, it's not the problem that is usually identified by traditional critics. They claim that standardized test scores are dropping, which is actually not true for the most part. But where there is a problem is that we rarely understand ideas from the inside out in across a variety of disciplines and feel that schooling is meaningful and come to be curious, creative, critical thinkers. Mm-hmm. I like to give the example of the number of success stories who came out of our schools and ask the question, how do you divide one fraction by a second fraction? And a lot of people, even though it's a fairly basic point that was taught over and over again, don't remember, which is itself a rather telling indictment of the traditional approach. But even when people do remember, as I'm proud to tell you I do, you take the second fraction and you flip it over and then multiply, I then like to ask, why? I have no idea, you know, because even though I received what was supposed to have been a good old school education, and I remember the fact, and I scored well on the tests because I had memorized the little trick, the algorithm, I have no idea why, because I was never engaged in thinking about mathematical principles, what lies behind the actions we perform. And the same thing is true in science and history and literature and so on. And the sad fact is that same sort of open wide, here come a bunch of facts to prepare you for a test, continues today and, in fact, is getting worse with the whole tougher standards drive.
Yeah. You know, look, thinking back to when I was in school, I think one of the reasons I was so turned off in my math classes is there wasn't that kind of explanation of why you do it this way, and what it means and what it's good for. There was no language for why math is exciting.
And it's not just that the teacher failed to offer an explanation. The problem runs deeper than that. The way kids learn, just to stick with math for a minute, though we can move on to other topics, the way kids really learn to be able to estimate quantities and be conversant in mathematical principles is by making meaning in an active way. So, for example, in some of the best classrooms, the non-traditional ones, the teacher might put a problem on the board and say, I'm not going to show you how to do this, you know. Work with each other and try to figure out how you might solve this problem. And then we'll argue about it in a caring way afterward. And that way kids come to invent some of the things like borrowing from the tens column, you know, or inverting fractions, because they really understand it thoroughly. In some of the best math classrooms, too, the problems grow out of questions that kids really have, things that were in the newspaper this morning that require some quantitative savvy to understand, or what's the fairest way to divide up a pizza, or how can we keep track of how fast we're growing. You start with questions and interests and problems that are meaningful, and then you acquire the facts and skills in the course of finding and making answers to those meaningful questions. That is the direct opposite of the sort of back-to-basics drill-and-skill approach that is driven by lectures and textbook and practice on you know, naked numbers that have nothing to do with anything. So if you didn't understand the principle, you're sure not going to understand it now. You're just going to feel stupid when the teacher gives you 50 more, just like the one that was put on the board. And if you do understand the principle, it's really not going to help very much.
Hmm. Is there any role for drills, for direct instruction, for lectures?
Those are three different questions. Let's start with lectures. Yes, if direct instruction means that the teacher simply provides information and the students listen to it, I think there is a role for it, but the role is far, far less than what is normally done in the overwhelming majority of American schools in the present day, from first grade all the way up, although it gets worse as you go up. Beyond the simple amount of time that is spent with kids passively lapping up and writing down what they're told, there's a question of when it's done and how it's done and with what kind of knowledge. For example, if the information we're talking about is how you create a business letter in the conventional way,
mm-hmm.
or how many days this month has, then it's not as problematic for the teacher to simply tell the kids. But if we're talking about ideas where there's logical relationships among quantities or qualities, historical facts, understanding literature, making sense of scientific phenomena, then I think the role for any kind of direct instruction goes way down, because now you're memorizing vocabulary words for the most part, or dates. You're not learning how to think like an historian or a scientist. Moreover, the teacher in the best classrooms would provide the explicit instruction or name for a given phenomenon after the kids have actively been engaged in figuring stuff out for themselves and with one another. Even in high school, I think there's a relatively smaller role for that kind of direct instruction than is normally the case. But when we're talking about young kids, there shouldn't be more than, you know, a few short periods a day where the teacher is doing the telling. You know, a friend of mine and a very influential educator, Deborah Meyer, has said that learning is mostly about talking, and teaching is mostly about listening. And I think that is a wonderful aphorism that sums up a huge quantity of research about how learning actually happens. The trouble is that most of us, most parents, for example, have never been invited to rethink the old-style approach, and we get nervous if our kids are in a classroom, if we're lucky enough to have kids in a classroom where they're doing that kind of active learning. Now, we think, well, the teacher knows more. The teacher should be telling the kids what they know, what she knows or he knows. And that's not what normally happens. As for drill or rote practice, in some cases, there is a very limited role for that. Once we're sure that the student already has actively made sense of the idea, and then there are some things where you want to work out a few examples of it yourself. But again, we have a long, long, long way to go in this country before we have to worry about too little of drill and practice or lecture and direct instruction.
Hmm. How would you make over the traditional elementary school classroom?
Well, first, although it's a hypothetical question, I should emphasize that even if it were in my power to wave a magic wand and change how everything is done, it's not going to last unless the teachers have been brought in on that whole process. You can't change what goes on in classrooms. Your governor can't, the superintendent of your school district can't, I can't. All we can do is invite teachers to reflect in a different way about how learning actually happens. What would I like it to look like? I actually have a little chart, mostly for parents, at the end of The Schools Our Children Deserve, in which I indicate what I think are the hallmarks or the earmarks of a terrific classroom as opposed to one that's not so good. Among the features I look for are, first of all, chairs around tables so kids are from the very furniture, getting a message that this is about learning with and from each other, not facing front and lapping up stuff. Second, I would want to see kids' questions and interests playing a direct and consistent role in creating a foundation for where the learning happens. There are facts and skills I want kids to have, but I know well enough the literature on this to realize that those can't be done as disconnected facts or a list of skills that are on somebody's, you know, what every nth grader must know list or curriculum guide that's imposed on teachers and rammed into their classrooms. So I want to take my cue from the kids, but I also want to have teachers introduce ideas and conflicts, problems and challenges, so that the kids aren't just asked, what do you want to do today? They are introduced to things that open up areas of interest and relevance where they didn't even know they were interested. That's the mark of a truly skillful teacher. I think in the best classrooms, the kids have a lot to say, even in kindergarten, about what they're going to do next and with whom and when and how their learning will be assessed and why. So there's more choice, there's more collaboration, and there's less of a notion that learning has to occur in separate disciplines. Okay, put your math books away and take out your science books, boys and girls. That's artificial. You know, we start out with questions that kids have, like, you know, what's the future going to be like, or why do wars happen? Or I want to tell you something I heard about something that was going on at the zoo. And then under the guidance of a skillful teacher, in finding out answers to these questions and asking better, more complex questions, kids end up acquiring a substantial amount of proficiency in the traditional fields of writing and reading and science and art and so on. But if you separate the disciplines artificially, as most of us have been trained to do, you're at a disadvantage to begin with. When I walk into a classroom, though, one of the first things I look for, even when the kids are in a whole class discussion as opposed to learning in teams or small groups, is I listen to hear how many questions and challenges and statements are offered directly from one kid to the next kid. You know, where Jason turns to Sandy and says, you know, I disagree with that, Sandy, because when you said yesterday that blah, 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 and the teacher in many of these exchanges is listening carefully, but if the teacher controls virtually every exchange in the classroom, then we do not have a classroom that is about learning to the extent that's possible.
Yeah. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about one of the teachers that you introduce us to in The Schools Our Children Deserve, where the kids refer to their teacher as the North Star.
Ah, yeah, right. That's in a journal entry. One of the kids says that. This was a particular classroom that impressed me that I saw in the upper middle to upper elementary grades, in which they were pursuing a project on animal habitats. And in this particular classroom, the kids took a very active role in figuring out how they were going to explore this kind of thing. She told them that a zoo curator had hired them to make little desk-sized models of habitats for animals, and they were divided into teams, and they started investigating the geography and the resources of whatever place their animal came from, like you know, Florida for the dolphin and so on. And they ended up writing up their findings on little scrolls in the habitats. They had to learn mathematical skills in order to construct the habitats, you know, so they were learning about perpendiculars and so on and multiplication in order to do something that mattered, you know, which is so different from the basic skills classroom where you learn it because it's the next chapter in the textbook and, you know, and or this year we're supposed to be doing, you know, double-digit multiplication. And the kids were reflecting and arguing about how to construct their habitats. They were learning about geography. They were learning how to write. They had to keep a running total of how much money, you know, play money they were spending to construct this. So they were learning the basic skills in math. And then they would come together in these class meetings. And and do little experiments that were relevant to the whole habitat question. This went on for months, this habitat project, and it made some of the parents nervous until they actually walked into the classroom and they just sucked in their breaths at the complexity of the thinking that was going on. This is the kind of classroom where it was not about just coughing up right answers. It was about arguing about controversial questions and learning more deeply. And it all grew out of this larger project, which was intellectually engaging in a way that most hard academic classrooms aren't. That's an important distinction. Harder is not necessarily better. For example, most advanced placement or AP classes in high school are harder than the other classes in the high school. Well, that doesn't mean they're better from a pedagogical point of view, because they're still doing, you know, lecture and textbook-based instruction in most of these classrooms. And the goal is to pass a test. So they have to cover a whole bunch of stuff superficially. Whenever a standardized test is driving the instruction, you know, we parents should worry, because the opportunity to explore deeply certain aspects of the curriculum are almost always lost.
Mm. Back to this classroom where where the kids are working on these environments.
Yeah.
Another thing that was going on in that classroom is the kids were encouraged to think about how they were thinking.
Right.
And what they were doing and what it meant. And they wrote these journals about what was going on in the classroom.
Yeah.
And they were asked, you know, well, what does learning mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote, we thought about it for a while, and we thought the kids ask the questions, and we go exploring to find the answer on our own instead of the teacher asking the questions and giving the answer. You are the traveler, and Ms. Migdal's the North Star.
Yeah. And that rules out the two conventional approaches, the one real one and the one caricatured one that we think of for teachers. The real one is that the teacher directs almost everything and makes all the decisions, tells you what to read, gives you the way to solve the problem, decides who's going to talk by arrogating to herself, the sort of you calling on the kids who raise their hands. The teacher does everything.
And says, one day you'll thank me for this.
Yeah, right. And in fact, well, we can extrapolate based on our own experience. We often thank and feel good about the teachers who were at least nice people, even though they had a classroom that really wasn't about investigating ideas, because very few of us have had many such teachers. So this, and we judge a good teacher as somebody who's, you know, knows his or her subject matter well, stays in control of the classroom, seems to care about students, and so on. And frankly, to be honest with you, I was one of those teachers. I used to think I was a great teacher because I knew my stuff. I loved my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was a good talker. I explained things well. And it took me years to realize that I really didn't know the first thing about how kids learn. The classroom was all about me. It wasn't about the kids. And as a result, a few of the kids would memorize this stuff or be a little bit inspired, but most of the kids were not really actively learning. Then there's the traditionalists like to draw this ridiculous cartoon version of progressive classrooms where, you know, anything is good and it's a PC feel-good fad and we don't require kids to know anything and the teacher just sits back and waits for the kids to teach themselves. And I don't know anybody who actually does that or defends that approach to teaching. But the North Star metaphor that a kid came up with in this classroom is wonderful. Because the star is what's guiding you in a way. The teacher plays a very active role in such a classroom, and it's a lot harder to play a role where you are facilitating the process by which the kids come to make sense of ideas without being on center stage most of the time. It's easy to sit back and drink your coffee and wait for the kids to learn. It's also easy to just, you know, lecture at them endlessly or tell them what to do. What's really hard is to play a role where you're, as one person put it, the guide on the side instead of the sage on the stage.
How do we, though, make certain that that kids, when they get through a grade, you know, have some knowledge, you know.
Yeah. How do we
make sure that, you know, I know you don't like the idea of, you know, here's a list of what every certain grader should know
right.
at the end of that year.
Right.
But well, there've got to be some skills and some mm-hmm. knowledge and understanding that we've kids have got to
right.
have.
Well, there's several things. Maybe the answer to the question emerges from looking at what's wrong with the what every nth grader should know approach, what I call the bunch of facts approach to schooling. One problem with it is it says that all kids, even in the earliest years, have to develop at the same pace. Any time you talk about grade-by-grade standards, even standards I happen to think are pretty good, and you say every seven-year-old needs to know this, that is an abomination. It flies smack in the face of what we know about kids' development, how kids develop at different speeds and in different ways, especially in the early years, and that's perfectly acceptable. Anytime you say every kid's got to know this much, you're creating business for, you know, people who are specialists who swoop in to take kids who are in trouble, and in fact they may just develop late. It's very different to say by the time a kid graduates from high school, we expect the following. That bothers me less, all else being equal, than saying every second grader needs to know this. The second problem is, are we talking about basic capabilities? Like around this time, a kid should be able to make a coherent argument or have some sense of how to estimate numerical quantities, or get a sense of what's the difference between a scientific finding as opposed to something that is a superstition. I have less problem with that than I have with expectations that are test-based that are basically about a bunch of facts. You know, by now, you must know long division. By this point, you must know the names of the explorers of the New World. And this is not about meaning and understanding, and it's not the stuff that most of us care about primarily for our kids. When I work with parents, and as well as teachers all over the country, I ask them, what are your long-term goals for your kids? What do you want them to have and be like after they've left you? And when people talk about intellectual stuff as opposed to being caring, compassionate, responsible, and so on, people say, I want my kid to be a lifelong learner, to be able to communicate effectively, to be a critical thinker, to be creative. You know, nobody ever says, I want my kid to be able to work a binomial equation, or to have remembered, you know, the guy whose assassination started World War I without having to look it up. But that's what our schooling is based on, is this bunch of facts approach. Now, if we take broad goals that have to do with intellectual capabilities instead of a mess of facts, and if we do it in a way that is not necessarily limited, everybody must be at this place at this time, then now we can ask this question, how do we know if we're being successful? One way is to have kids collect their learning, their achievements, their projects in what are sometimes called portfolios that can be assessed according to a fairly standard set of criteria and can help parents and the kids themselves assess whether they are improving and learning what seems to be appropriate. Another way is to have kids do actual performances or exhibitions that show us in a way far more meaningful than any paper or pencil test, what they are able to do and how they're able to think and how capable they are according to a bunch of measures. But, you know, there's one other answer to this question, and that is to ask the kids. For example, I'll tell you a quick story. I'll try to make it quick. There's an approach to middle school learning that's been pioneered by some folks in Wisconsin where the entire year's curriculum grows out of a series of questions that the kids are invited to ask in the first week of school. But what questions do you have about yourself and about the world? And where do those two sets of questions overlap? And they come out with broad themes that may have to do with the future, for example, and other things like that. And they spend a whole year acquiring competence in various fields while they find answers to the questions that matter to them. And this is astonishing to witness because it turns young adolescents who have a few other things on their minds into really rigorous scholars. And it's really rigorous in the best sense of that word, not in the sense we hear these days of tougher standards, raise the bar. which is usually about accelerating the worst kind of instruction, these kids really become thinkers. But at some point during the year, the instructor worries a little bit. You know, how do we know that in the process of doing all this great project exploration, the kids have been are now able to do stuff most people expect 12 or 13-year-olds to be able to do? And the answer, which is the answer to a lot of questions, is ask the kids. Bring them in on this process so they're thinking about their thinking. And say to them, you know, a lot of folks really hope and expect that kids your age would be able to do X, Y, and Z. Have we acquired those competences, or have we missed those, and do we need to do a special unit to make sure we're okay? Let's discuss this. That process helps the kids to do more thinking of an even more sophisticated way, and if it does come time to do a little mini unit on, you know, I don't know, division or writing up a lab report or some sense of American history that we missed, it's far less oppressive to them and far more inviting to them if they were part of the process of deciding that we need to do this.
Hmm. Taxpayers and voters and politicians want to know on a large scale how schools are doing.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about the issue of accountability in that sense?
Well, I think when you phrase it that way in very broad terms, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to want to know.
Mm-hmm.
However, this has been mangled and warped to the point that we are now trying to rate and rank schools as though we were, I don't know, measuring cattle or something, to the point that the measures we're using have come to drive the whole process of instruction. There are horrible, horrible standardized tests that are being used that not only miss the point and fail to really gauge whether kids can think, as opposed to temporarily memorize a bunch of formulas and words, but the extent to which schools have been transformed into giant test prep centers is the extent to which our kids' education is going backward. So when people talk about tougher standards and then they in effect, define that in terms of raising scores on standardized tests, they're actually making schools worse. And I think a lot of parents have really never been invited to think about that. They may be annoyed at all the time given to the testing, but they don't recognize that if a local official says, you know, our test scores went up this year, that the correct response from the parent, I think, should be, you know, if this is what mostly concerns you, then I'm worried about the quality of education my kid is getting here. So how do you as a parent get a sense that schools are doing what they ought to? Well, go visit is the easy answer and possibly the most profound. Because when you walk through a school and smell the air and listen about and watch the extent to which kids are grappling with important ideas and making choices about their learning, and it feels like a community of learners, you already have a sense that more sophisticated kind of thinking is going on. And if you go there and you find kids in rows of desks hunched over worksheets or taking spelling quizzes or getting letter grades and trying to raise those grades, there are other ways as well. For example, I mentioned a moment ago that we can assess an individual child's learning by having them collect portfolios of their learning. Well, there are ways to judge the quality of those portfolios and sample a few kids here and there throughout a district that will give you a sense of the quality of the learning that's going on in that district without ever using, an IGAP test or its successor in Illinois, much less tests that are absolutely abhorrent and worse than meaningless like the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, the Comprehensive Test of Basic Skills, the Stanford or California tests, which besides being all multiple choice and timed and one-shot high-anxiety assessments are also not even designed to tell you how well kids are learning or schools are doing. They're designed to rank schools against one another. If a parent says, I want to have a sense of how well my kid is understanding or whether, as a taxpayer, schools are doing what they ought to, the last thing you would ever look at is a test that is purported in percentile terms, because that doesn't tell you anything about the quality of the school. It just says who's doing better than whom at the moment. And indeed, the questions on those tests are not even designed to tell you whether kids know what they should. They're designed specifically to spread out the scores as much as possible. So that, for example, on a test like the ITBS, I mean, upstate in Chicago, you have a nightmare scenario going on where not only is it test-driven, but you have kids being held back a year, despite research showing that that is absolutely destructive for students to be flunked a year, on the basis of how well they do on a test that was never even designed to tell you how well students learn. So, for example, if everybody does well on a question on a test like the ITBS or the Stanford's, that question will probably be thrown out. They don't want questions that everyone does well on because it's not meant to assess the quality of schools. But then we have to also really question our need for numbers here. If kids are coming home from a given school babbling excitedly about stuff they figured out that they never understood before, or they are continue to argue animatedly about some topic they were arguing about in class, even after class is over, or they not only can read, but do read on their own, then the chances are that school is doing something right. And the fact that that's harder to quantify, the extent of their engagement with the learning, doesn't mean that it's less useful or meaningful as a measure than how well good test takers score on bad tests.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. We're talking this afternoon about our approach to elementary and secondary education. Our guest is Alfie Cohn. He's a parent. He's a former teacher. He's now an author and a lecturer. He's an outspoken critic of traditional classrooms and the back-to-basics approach and the raise-the-bar approach to schooling. He's the author of 7 books. His latest is The Schools Our Children Deserve, Moving Beyond Traditional Classrooms and Tougher Standards. You can join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Okay, how do we know that your makeover would improve the quality of education? Is there evidence, is there research to back up your point of view?
Yeah, and I've collected it in the book. I segregated it into a very long appendix so that people who are more interested in the ideas and in stories from around classrooms around the country don't have to be bogged down by the research. But those who do want to see the data, as I would, can find it there. And it systematically goes through different topics and controversies in education and shows how, for example, contrary to what has become the big lie in education in this country, an approach to learning how to read in which kids are writing even before they can spell, in which they are developing skills of phonics in the context of rich literature, what is sometimes called the whole language approach, is not only nicer or cuter, it works better than the traditional direct instruction of explicit phonics, you know, where you spend your time circling vowels or reading vocabulary-controlled stupid passages. But where the kids are collaborating or making choices or doing rich stuff, the research is phenomenal at showing that approach not only helps kids to like reading and writing more, they do it better in most cases. Then I go through the research on mathematics, demonstrating that the kind of classroom that I described before, where kids have to figure out how to do stuff on their own and are tackling real-life problems, works so much better than, you know, the worksheet and textbook approach at helping kids understand mathematical principles, and even works as well or slightly better when you just measure them on basic computation skills. And then I go through the early childhood stuff, much of which, by the way, was done in, some of this research was done in Illinois, and specifically in downstate Illinois, where there were early studies showing that the kind of preschools that kids go to can have a significant effect for years, the best approach being one that is least like the drill and skill instruction, which sadly is being forced on kids younger and younger and younger. There are, adverse consequences years later for kids when they go to preschool and have to memorize their colors and numbers and letters on some sort of schedule to prepare them for kindergarten, to prepare them for first grade, to prepare them for a test, and so on.
Okay. I want to interrupt here, and I want to ask you just a little bit to talk with us just briefly about the damage that you think is being done by that kind of system in preschool. But I also want to let you know that we've got a number of callers waiting to talk with us. So, talk with us about the preschool problem.
Any academic advantage that's gained from a sort of drill-and-skill preschool curriculum is quickly washed away, according to the research. After a year or two, those kids are not any better, even at basic skills, than those who are in a more holistic or developmentally appropriate and I can unpack those terms later if you want, kind of preschool. But there's even some research indicating they suffer much more anxiety. And one study that was done in Michigan suggested that years later into adulthood, you have poorer sort of social adjustment for kids who are in that kind of drill and skill approach. More, obviously, in the book.
All right. Well, let's take some calls.
Sure.
Our first caller this afternoon is on the toll-free line on a car phone. Good afternoon. Okay, let's go and take another call. Our next caller on line 2 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, okay. I thought I was line 1.
We all think we're line 1.
I'm following up on the one you said about that they throw out some of the questions in the big tests. Everybody scores well on them.
Yeah.
Some 5 years ago or so, they rescored the SATs. And I predicted to all my friends, you just wait a couple of years and they'll come out waving all sorts of things, saying that everybody's improving instead of going down. And two things, I was really surprised that it didn't even take them 1 year to do that. They did it the very next fall. And I was out in Northern California and heard, read in the paper, that nobody scored 1,600 in all of Northern California. That's millions of kids. They had two twins that scored 1580, and we had a couple dozen people just at Urbana High School that got 1600s. I heard that they were trying to narrow the standard deviation to keep anybody from falling off the bottom end or going off the top end. Can you comment about
that? Well, the SAT test is distinct from some of the others I'm talking about in one important respect, besides the fact that it's given to high schoolers instead of kids who are younger, and that is that it exists only to decide who's better than whom and who gets to get into college. So it's the scores overall on the SAT, if you want to look at how well everybody did in a given year, or you want to look at if scores are better in Illinois than they are in California, that is primarily telling you not about how good the schools are. It's telling you how many of the kids who could have taken the test did. I can make all the SAT scores go up for Illinois, by an extraordinary extent next year, just by having only the top 10% of...
Right, I've heard that stuff.
Yeah, it's now the SAT was renormed, to use the technical term, which not to prove that schools were getting better. In fact, there seems to be a strong political tendency to use tests for the precise opposite point, which is to prove that our public school system is a failure.
Well, the year I took it, a lot of people wanted to sue them because you realize how old I am now. That year, they had a negative correlation. It was actually worse than flipping a coin to determine how well you did in college.
Yeah, it's not negative, but it overall over the years it accounts for a tiny proportion of the variance, even for freshman college grades, much less long-term career stuff. It doesn't measure anything that's that significant, except income. It tells you a lot about how big the houses are of the kids who took it. That's the thing that correlates very significantly. I mean, the SAT verbal and the ACT, too, which is more popular in the Midwest, just like it, it's just a vocabulary test. It has nothing to do with thinking. Or that's not actually correct. Let me revise that. It does have to do with thinking. One study showed that there was a slight negative correlation between how well kids did on the SAT and how deeply they thought about the issues that were involved. Like many other standardized tests, its real relationship is a negative one with depth of thought. Mm. And it's used because it makes the life of admissions officers easier, not because it tells us much. But as much as I can find fault with the SAT and the ACT, I'm not even mostly concerned about that. I'm concerned with tests that are at least as bad, that are being imposed upon all of the kids, even when they're much younger, and then used as a basis for whether to give them a a high school diploma or let them go on to fourth grade or which schools we're going to spend money on. It's an outrage, frankly.
I want to thank the caller for his call, and I want to go on to another call as we're drawing down here on our time. Our next caller is on line 3, a caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to say I'm sorry that I didn't get in earlier. I've just been driving around listening to this. I couldn't disagree with you more. I have a child who is dyslexic. Both my children, one is now a ninth grader, one is a sixth grader. They both went to a school which believes in whole language. Whole language works very well for motivated, preferably little girls who sit there and go and choose books that they're interested in and learn from them. Children who are not like that learn absolutely nothing.
That couldn't be farther from the truth, according to the best research. In fact,
then explain to me why I have a sixth grader who still has terrible, terrible difficulties.
Well, you know, I don't know what was going on in the name of whole language.
I work at the university library, and nobody can write a coherent sentence. My colleagues, when they send emails and letters and things, I mean, education standards should be ratcheted up, not down.
Well,
and I mean, it is absolutely, completely and utter bunkum. I just came away from people laughing because a colleague of mine used the words usurp. And they said, oh, ha, 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 we're just plain folks here. How can somebody use a word like that? We don't understand. What does that mean? I think that and they are reverting all over this country and certainly in Europe to traditional methods where people at least emerge with some knowledge and some common culture. It is absolutely ridiculous not to expect somebody to know who was shot at the start of the First World War and to just devise their own programs. Children do not devise their own programs. They sit and play Pokemon cards, and I'm getting off the phone. I'll listen to your reply.
Okay, thanks for
There's
the call.
There's a lot of stuff there all mixed up together, yeah. Which is often the case from the traditional point of view, which we don't have time enough to disentangle. A lot of times when kids don't know what the word usurp means or have failed to remember, you know, the assassination of someone in World War I or are unable to put together a coherent sentence, the vast majority of classrooms that produced those kids that the caller is complaining about are the traditional back-to-basics classrooms where those facts were taught in rote fashion without understanding. That doesn't mean we have a cure-all here, but it means that in a meaningful sense, by moving to the kind of classroom that I've been describing, which includes kids being absolutely saturated in a literate environment, this is a way of raising standards. If I was going to dumb down classrooms, I would give out more worksheets and have more standardized tests and have teachers do more of the lecturing. Because remember, in all of the decades that we have had people complaining about schools and pointing backward to the generation before, there was the supposed golden era. In almost all of that time, and in almost all of the country, we have had very, very traditional approaches to schooling. The research suggests that kids in well-taught, whole-language classrooms are far more coherent in their ability to put together ideas. They're not left to their own devices to play Pokemon, but rather they are engaged, and they don't want to be just doing other stuff during that period. They're excited about what they're doing because for once someone is listening to them. They get to have more choice about which books they're reading and how to respond to them. It's the places where the kids have tuned out, zoned out, and are not learning much tend to be the cases where the teacher just tells you what to do and it's all about a bunch of different skills.
Yeah. We've got to wrap up here, but I do want to ask, are there children for whom traditional schooling is good, for whom it works?
Depending on how we're defining traditional schooling, I would say that if you understand, as we said before, that a progressive classroom or a non-traditional classroom does include some direct instruction, and the teacher is playing a role, as long as we haven't turned the opposite of traditional schooling into a caricature, then I have yet to meet the child who benefits in terms of understanding from a classroom that is primarily about disconnected skills, where the teacher takes over. I would say there are some students who relish the traditional classroom when they happen to be the narrow band of kids who are good at short-term memorization. And they often enjoy, in a way that's not terribly laudable, the opportunity to not really take responsibility for their own education. It's the non-traditional classrooms that push kids to do more, that expect more of teachers. Whole language is far more rigorous intellectually than doing worksheets on diphthongs. And so in the long run, even though some kids say, I want you to decide what we're going to do next, the opportunity to be brought in on that decision in a way that traditional classrooms almost never do benefits virtually all kids.
Yeah, I wish we had more time. I'm sorry to have to wrap things up here. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Alfie Cohen has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Schools Our Children Deserve, Moving Beyond Traditional Classrooms and Tougher Standards.